Hey, my name's Emma.
Hey, my name's Maddie.
And you're listening to The Pilots Pandemic. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to this week's episode of The Pilots Pandemic podcast. You're here with your host, Emma, and our other host, Maddie.
Hey, guys.
And we are here today with our guest, Chris Nathan. We actually connected with Chris through my spotlight in the AOPA magazine, which is super awesome. And I always love the power of connection. So, Chris, just give yourself a little bit of an introduction.
Hi, ladies. I'm really happy to be a part of this. And I'm glad that we got connected via the spotlight in the AOPA magazine. I'm embroiled in a battle with the FAA over a third class medical. And when that article came out, my dad called me, was like, "You got to look this up. These people are doing exactly what you're doing. They can help you. You got to talk to them."
Our favorite snack from our favorite female aviator. Avionola packs so much flavor that there are endless possibilities of concoctions that you can make with this granola.
You guys, we are talking about recipes like mini keto cupcakes, tropical Avionola collagen smoothies, buckwheat Avionola cakes, Avionola parfaits, and even chocolate granola bark. Go to the Avionola Instagram page at avi_foods_co. That's at avi_foods_co to get your hands on these recipes and order yourself some delicious granola made by a female aviator. Use code PILOTSPANDEMIC for 15% off your order.
So at the start of each show, we always want to ask our guests, like, how did you get into aviation and what kind of sparked that passion for you?
Well, that spark started really early on. I'm actually a third generation pilot. My grandfather was in the Army Air Corps. He was a flight engineer on B-18s. He was stationed on the island of Oahu. And in the fall of 1941, he and nine of his friends went in on a Taylor E-2. They bought for $600 between the 10 of them because they wanted to, you know, they were flying as crewmen, but they wanted to be pilots. So they started training in that little airplane. And then, you know, the Japanese had some other ideas about how that winter was going to go. That airplane survived. He survived, went on to fly. He was type rated in 40 some different airplanes, spent a career in the Air Force flying everything. He went on to work for the State Department. He literally built the Air Force for the country of Laos. And then my dad got his private in 1978. He was a Sky Marshal. My mom was a stewardess, not a flight attendant, stewardess for Pan Am, mm-hmm. or a TWA, I mean. And then my dad had a career change, you know, midlife. He got his instrument commercial and started flying Part 135. He went on to get he's ATP rated. He's been a bush pilot in Alaska for the last, I don't know, since the early 90s. He's, you know, 20,000 hour pilot. So I started real young. I mean, I grew up on the airport. My first job was working for a family friend, stripping paint on airplane parts. I would wash bellies of everybody's airplanes to, you know, to make money. To go fly. There was a flight. This was in Tucson, Arizona at Ryan Field. There was a flight school down the way from the hangar we worked in, where my dad did his training, where my mom did her training, called Snoopy's Flight School. And the chief pilot there was a guy named Denny Gensman, who's something of a legend. But they had a Cessna 150 that you could rent, or it was an Aerobat you could rent for $20 an hour. So I would wash bellies of airplanes to make enough money to go fly with my dad. And then all through high school, I was in Civil Air Patrol. I did some glider training. I started on my A&P through an apprenticeship program. was just like absolutely embroiled in the life until I went to college, and then it wasn't in the cards for me, and I kind of drifted away. But probably 6 years ago, I got the bug again, started looking into it, started thinking about it, started running numbers on what it would take, and then in 2020, when the world slowed down, I own an audiovisual staging and rental company. Our industry came to an absolute standstill. All business, like nobody could have meetings for that year. So I found myself with a lot of time on my hands, and decided that I wasn't gonna let 2020 slip past without making some personal progress. So I found a flight school and started training.
That's awesome. Pretty amazing. Sorry, like aviation is just like part of you, because I'm like, wow, you did a lot of like pathways doing, you said AMP, which is kind of cool. And then you worked on the ground with the airplanes too. So, and I was like mulling over in my mind too, the $20 an hour for flight training.
How crazy is that, right?
I'm like, what?
Yeah, I wish that was wet still cost. That was all in.
Wow. Yeah. I'm jealous.
This was a long time ago.
Yeah, I know. I was just thinking about that, because my next question I was going to ask you, talking about me going to ground school right now, and luckily, it's free for me because my husband's a CFII, so he's actually doing my ground school for me, and then I'm hoping he can train me too, because I think that would just be really special. But I'm like, if I don't have that, like, I'm going to have to pay quite a bit of money myself. Yeah, I wish that I could do the $20 an hour. That'd be pretty amazing. But so with all of your background in aviation, and now that you're going through this, obviously to get your third class medical, but you do have your PPL, right?
I do, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I started training December of 2020, like December 3rd, I think, was my first like actual, like, let's log this flight. I soloed the end of that month. And I passed my check right in March of 21.
Wow. So you went really fast through your
I did. I training. Jumped right into it with both feet, and
you're amazing.
I took it real serious.
I don't know if I'll go that fast. But I was going to ask you, like, what's one piece of advice you'd give me or any student pilot that's just starting out?
I'll give you two pieces of advice, actually. Number one, this is what my instructor told me, and I think that she absolutely hit it on the head. If you can, do your ground school and your early flight training at the same time. The lessons you're learning in one apply directly to the other. And they make way more sense if you're practicing the things that you're learning about in ground school.
Yes.
That worked. It worked really well for me. It was like, cause I did my ground school online, through, the sporties course. And, and so, at night I'd be taking, watching the videos and taking the quizzes and studying the stuff. And then I'd get up the next day and I'd go fly, and it'd be like, oh, this totally makes sense to me. Slow flight is, it's so that you don't panic and you practice, you're landing without landing. It's like,
yes.
All the lessons, they, like I said, they tie together so completely that if you do both at the same time, it'll all be easier. And then my second piece of advice, which is hard and it's expensive and it's difficult, but do it fly as much as you can and as often as you can, because it's all, it's muscle memory, and it's the brain power. You lose it way quicker than you think you're gonna. So the more often you can fly to get through and apply the lessons and stack all the learning on top of it, what you're learning, the skills, they're perishable skills, which is why you got to do a biannual flight review, because if you're not using them, you're going to lose them. So especially in training, just do it. I was flying, 3-4 times a week to try and just get through it, and it made it a whole lot easier. Like, oh yeah, yesterday I did this.
So yes,
that would be my advice.
I'm definitely someone who is like that practical application, like really cements things into my mind. I'm a definite questioner, so I ask like tons of questions, which I think helps too. But I am seeing like me not doing it in the plane, I can see how I could lose it quickly. So I love that you said that, because I'm like, should I just start taking my flight lessons like now? And now that you said that, that's a yes. I should be
100%.
Yeah, I definitely have to echo that message. I think that's both of those things were what I feel like I messed up with during my PPO. I tried to bulk. Like, our school wanted us to pretty much get all the ground school and the written out of the way as soon as possible. So I did the entire Sporties PPL course. And I think like 3 weeks, I think it was like a month, a little over a month. And I had no clue. Like, I went in to take my written, I failed. I had no clue what was going on. Came back, studied really, really hard for another week, and then went in, passed it. But the other part of that was I felt like I also was not able to fly as much as I wanted to. And then going into my IFR, I flew really, really consistently. I think like 4 days a week. And I got through my IFR really, really quick, and super proficiently. So I definitely would have to say those are two solid pieces of advice. But so kind of moving on, I know we talked earlier and we've kind of hinted at it a little bit, but you've had a little bit of a hiccup with your medical. So can you share more about this?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I guess we'll start at the beginning. In 2015, I went through, the American male rite of passage. That was my divorce year. And that was a hard time for me. So I went and I got some help. I went and found a psychiatrist, and they put me on an antidepressant. I was on an SSRI for about 6 months, which I didn't really care for. And so we switched me over to a different drug. They put me on Wellbutrin, which is not on the FAA's approved list of antidepressants. I got off it, and then in 2017 felt myself like, oh, you know, maybe my brain should be working better. Went back, got some more help, found an amazing psychiatrist, and she put me back on the Wellbutrin, and I was on it for a little over a year. And then well before I started training, I met with her. I was like, all right, I'm thinking about doing this. I want to get my rating. Let's talk through what it would take to safely get off this. She was 100% on board. So we, weaned me off the drugs nice and carefully, and then gave it a fair amount of time before I even started to make sure that, that we were doing everything as carefully as possibly. But that particular antidepressant is, like I said, is not on the list of the four that are approved by the FAA. And Wellbutrin particularly has a pretty specific stigma attached to it in regards to aviation safety. So I applied for my third class medical when I started training. My AME signed off on it, no problem. But you got to fill out, any medications you've ever been on. I wasn't on any, but I filled out, here's my history. And it got flagged. The FAA reached out, asked for some more information. I went to my brain doctor. She was like, oh yeah, she took it real serious. She called the FAS in Oklahoma City. Like, specifically, what do I have to do, to make sure this goes through? What do I have to send you to, to prove that this is cool? They told her, she sent everything. And about 6 weeks after my check ride, I got a certified letter telling me that my third class had been officially denied. And I've been appealing and fighting ever since.
How long has that process been so far?
Oof, that was the FAA's got a real great sense of timing. That denial came on my birthday in 2021. So May of 21, they said no. I appealed. They said no again in July of 21. I appealed again. They said no in, must have been September of 21. And then I tried to escalate it and asked for a special issuance, and was waiting on that until just a few weeks ago. It finally came back, the official no to the special issuance and the third class.
Wow. I'm sorry about that, because I didn't realize that you had like the total denial now.
Yep.
So one of the things that we talk about a lot is that, you know, the FAA has not expanded their drug list. There's only four SSRIs that you can take. And as Chris was saying, he has taken Wellbutrin, and you kind of said it, that there is a stigma attached, but that's what I wanted you to expand on, because we had talked about this in our pre-pod conversation about how Wellbutrin has been stigmatized, and there is a big reason why. So can you share with us why that is?
Wellbutrin has a bad reputation for one very specific incident. In 2015, I think it was. Must have been 2015. A co-pilot for German Wings, an airline in Germany, was having some mental health issues. Took a whole cocktail of drugs that weren't his, including Wellbutrin. And then while on a flight, escorted the pilot out of the cabin, locked the door behind him, and purposefully crashed an A320 into a mountain with 150 people on board. And the aviation safety community as a whole took that real seriously, and Wellbutrin immediately got put on a list of drugs that are considered dangerous for pilots, which is a real shame, because he wasn't even prescribed it. It's something he took to try and like self-medicate himself out of whatever he was going through. And I know a lot of people who've been on Wellbutrin, and it does a lot of good. It did me a lot of good.
Yeah, it's interesting, because you had pointed out too that it's not specifically the FAA that made this rule. It was Congress who made that rule. And it was kind of like a reactionary rule, because he took that. So that's the German Wings has really been huge on stigmatizing mental health and aviation. And then it's pretty sad, like, that I think his name is Andre Lepkowitz, took Wellbutrin, and he wasn't prescribed it. And now they've just said, nope, no one can take it, because they just associate those two things happening together. By taking Wellbutrin, you maybe do the same thing, which is completely untrue.
So
that's very frustrating.
It is.
It's interesting that they still like that there's such a like a stigma about it, that even after you being off of it for a certain amount of time, like, they're still just hard pressed with that no. And it's interesting, because I wonder, like, if it was any other drug, like say he had taken Lexapro or something like that, which is one of the approved for, would they feel the same way about that? I don't know. It's just, I don't know. Kind of sucks. It really sucks. Actually, it doesn't kind of suck. It majorly sucks. And I think that's a conversation that Maddie and I have a lot, is like, they definitely need to put more thought and science and research more about these drugs before drawing such a hard line in the sand. But so as we all know, there's so many facets to obtaining a medical, especially after you diagnose or disclose any kind of diagnosis. But what has been the hardest part about this process for you? Like an example, just like simply letting go of the identity, has any of that been hard for you?
The identity has been huge, because I, you know, I had a plan for how things were going to go, and what airplane I wanted to buy, and where I wanted to put it, and how I wanted to, you know, trips I wanted to take with my kids, and things I wanted to be able to do that are now pretty seriously backburnered. But I'd say the most frustrating part of it is the lack of information and lack of transparency, as well as just the impartial nature of the process. You submit your paperwork and you hope for the best. And, you know, there's a hotline you can call to check on the progress, and all they'll tell you is whether or not they've got it. They won't give you any information as far as what it is going to happen or what you know, what their decision is going to be. And you're just stuck waiting with no information for however long it takes. And it takes a long time. It's been, you know, it's been 2 years of dealing with this for me. And, you know, the entirety of communications over that 2 years has been, you know, 150 phone calls on my end to them, which just got me, yes, we've got it. It's under review. And then, you know, 4 letters in the mail, essentially. And then, you know, people who've never met me, have never spoken to me, you know, that just look through my records and decided for me.
Yeah.
Is that that's one of the most heartbreaking parts of this, you know, that the doctor who did treat me through the issues I was having, you know, advocated for me, probably the most positive doctor-patient relationship I've ever had, as far as somebody who just like really believed in working with me to get better and helping me through whatever, and then actively advocating for me in this process with the FAA. And then somebody who's never met me, never spoken to me goes, nope.
Yeah.
That's real frustrating.
It's baffling to me how that's like another thing that Maddie and I always speak about. It's just, I don't understand why they figure that having somebody who really knows nothing about you, regardless of what they're reading on paper, versus somebody who's known you, been treating you for, you know, however many years, it's like they ask for these letters and they want you to prove all this stuff to them, but it almost feels like it means nothing in the long run, because they're going to come up with whatever opinion they feel like based off of what they're reading, I just don't feel like you can make an accurate diagnosis when you don't even really know the person.
Well, that combined with the, you know, just really outdated standards that they're using, that's the biggest issue. It's the DSM that the regs are based on versus, you know, the modern medical take on mental health are two very different documents. So
yeah. And we're going to get into that, but I just want to ask you, Chris, like when you were going in to apply for your third class and going through the special issuance, did your dad or your family have anything to say, since they already have like know kind of the whole aviation system and they probably were aware of the air medical process? Did they give you like a warning or anything like that? Or were they just like, yeah, do it, you'll be fine?
My dad is in the middle of the same issue. He's waiting on his medical to get reinstated, and has been mm-hmm. for I think 3 years at this point. So he had some pretty salty advice for me, basically a pretty cynical take on it, because he's stuck in the same boat. But as far as specific, like here's how to do it, or here's how to, you know, what hoops to jump through, no. And that's been real frustrating, is that nobody seems to know how to navigate this system. Not nobody, but not very many people.
I mean, the people who kind of know or are close to it are the ones who have navigated it and either been accepted or have been denied. And typically the people that have been denied are like, don't say anything.
Yeah. Yep.
And the ones who have gotten their medical in the end are like, oh, it's all going to be fine. It's great, good, and all good and gravy or whatever. And it is interesting to talk to people who have gone through this system and had different outcomes and what they think. But like you said, at the end of the day, the system does need to be updated. That is the problem, is that it is so archaic and there are so many different areas that it could be updated and obviously just become more efficient, that's why you have these totally different viewpoints coming up for how to deal with your medical and going through a special issuance process. But if you could update the air medical process, what do you think you'd change about it and why?
If I could change the whole system, that's a great question, because it's so
loaded.
It's like,
yes.
Well, I mean,
if you could change like one thing about it, like one thing that you think would be make a big deal.
Sure. I'd say number one would be, you know, move to a modern take on mental health. Upgrade to the at least the DSM-5, and get or take take seriously the medical opinions of medical doctors who are treating patients versus the regulatory take on it in Oklahoma City and Washington. That would be step one. Like there's two different languages being spoken there, and there's no translation between, and it leaves people like me high and dry.
Yeah. So our listeners are probably like wondering, what is the DSM? Because I know obviously we've spoken about it. You just mentioned it, and we have touched on it a little bit on the show, but basically it's a standard system that utilizes that the FAA utilizes based on medical diagnoses pertaining to mental health. So right now the FAA is operating on DSM-3. And DSM stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And currently, if this is correct, I believe we are at DSM-6. So that means the FAA is like three iterations behind, which is kind of nuts. And I wish that we had the dates for all of these, because I believe like DSM-3 came out, it's like the 70s or the 80s.
The DSM-3 was started, like they started putting it together in 1974. It was published in 1980. And then there was a revision to the DSM-3. The DSM-3R came out in 87.
Which, again, is just really mind-blowing.
It was a long time ago.
That was before I was born, and I'm 34 years old.
Yeah.
Just even the way that we perceive mental health and the way that we go about dealing with mental health issues, even in the past 2 years has changed just so significantly. And then to think about something that's that old, it's just, mind-boggling. But so can you share, which you kind of did already share with our audience, like when the DSM-3 came out, but how does this affect you and how has it affected you throughout this whole process with your medical?
So that's interestingly enough, I just was able to review my records and look at, what my treating psychiatrist, how she described my my mental health issues. And it's listed per the DSM-5, like specific, like there's a code, like assigned to every mental health issue that could be. And mine is defined as a major depressive disorder, mild. The term mild doesn't exist in the DSM-3. It's major depressive disorder. You either have it or you don't, right? There's no, there's not the spectrum of severity, I guess would be the term. So when you look at my medical records and you see this, major depressive disorder mild, you go, oh, okay, mild. Well, if the regs are based on a system that's literally 35 plus years old, that doesn't include that, the idea of mild, not just the term, but the idea didn't exist in that, in that book. So therefore that's what gets applied to my denial.
It's just so interesting how they deal with things. And honestly, we've talked to, I think it was Bart Johnson who we talked to as well. And he said he was diagnosed with schizophrenia, but he totally believes he doesn't have that. But he can't get re-diagnosed now because he's already got his denial of his medical. So he's okay with it, but he really believes like if he would have been, it would have been up to date to the DSM that it is now, that his diagnosis would have been different and therefore he may have been issued a medical. And that's kind of the troubling thing, is that the system is not updated. And so you're basing it off of all of these old things, and lots of people are being punished for disclosing and for being honest.
Exactly.
And go ahead.
I just can imagine it's so frustrating to, like, you've put all this time and effort and work into not only getting your medical, but your mental health, and then just to be stamped as something that you're not. I don't know. That just seems really frustrating.
Well, and the fact that you realistically have to make a choice between the two. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I take my mental health very seriously. I went through a lot to get to where I am now. And I don't take it lightly. I work very hard at it. And I've got a lot of processes in place to make sure that I stay, you know, where I'm supposed to be, mental health wise. But, like, the idea that if I was having trouble, my go-to, like, if, you know, I have certain benchmarks that I compare myself to, and I look at where I'm at, and if I get to a certain point, you know, the answer is go get help, right? Call up my doctor, you know, make an appointment, go make a visit, figure out what's going on, you know, get some therapy. That choice has to be now weighed against what that's going to look like on my, you know, in my FAA medical records. Now, for me, that choice is easy. I'm going to choose my mental health because I really want to be a pilot. I've wanted to be a pilot my whole life. It's a thing I want very badly for my future, but it's not my livelihood. It's not my, you know, if my medical continues to be denied at this point, it's, you know, I still get to go to work tomorrow. I still have a career and a future. But for a lot of pilots, that's not an option. You got to make that choice, and you go, well, as soon as I admit that there's an issue and go get help, you know, now I'm stigmatized, and this could be the end of, you know, end of my career. And that's just, that is so far beyond heartbreaking. It's a travesty.
So I have a question that I didn't script in. I was just wondering if you are willing to tell me, how much money do you think that you've spent on the whole special issuance process and trying to get your medical back?
Well, the process thus far has all been just me. I did it all on my own, so it hasn't cost me anything yet. Okay. However, I'm pursuing a legal route now, and I don't know what that's going to cost. It hasn't we haven't tallied that up yet, but I don't think it's going to be cheap.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, well, either you pay for all the doctors and you go through that whole special issuance process, but now you're on the other side of it and you're just trying to get non-denial, right? Like, and is that, do you think that that's possible?
I do think it is possible. We've got a plan of action that we're working towards. But yeah, I don't know how long it's going to take, and I don't know how much it's going to cost.
Is part of that getting a re-diagnosis or getting that diagnosis kind of reversed?
Yes. Yep. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Do you think that they're really heavily focused on you taking Wellbutrin, though?
I don't know. I think that plays pretty heavily into it. The fact that I've been off of it for 4 years at this point, one would hope would weigh into that decision. But I researched, you know, a lot when I decided to, you know, prior to even starting flight training, when I decided I wanted to and was looking at getting off and off the Wellbutrin and talking to my doctor about it, like, I did a lot of research on how that was going to affect me. And what I'm afraid of coming up is what I found on a number of forums and people talking about it, was that what they really want to see is 10 years off of the drug.
Jesus.
So, yeah. So I could, if that's the standard they're going to hold me to on this particular problem, then I'm looking at 6 more years of waiting.
Oh,
yeah. Feels like a lot.
That is, we're actually, Emma and I have something coming up with talking to an aviation subcommittee expert, and I did put that on one of the action points, is like updating the drugs and taking Wellbutrin off of the no-go drug list. And I thought of you when I put it down. I was like, so we're so happy to have this on there. But it is, it's just so archaic, and I can't believe they are so distrusting. You know, like, it's not like this drug is still in your system, obviously. Right. But what, like, why a 10-year benchmark? Like, what in the world? That makes no sense. So that's another thing. It's like, where did they come up with these numbers and these timelines for the drugs that you take? Because you know that it's not in their system anymore. You have a doctor that's advocated for you and said that you're good to go. And like you said, you sent your paperwork in. You're just another number to them. They've never seen you. They don't know you. And they're just basing it off of what they see on paper. Right. And I really think that's just not right. And
well, and the fact that the only actual human that I interacted with in the process was the AME who did my medical exam, just like every other pilot. You got to go to an AME and you got to get an exam. I got that exam and he signed off on it. Like, he approved my medical. I had an approved third class medical in my pocket when I started flight training. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he just gets overridden by, you know, by a set of codes written by somebody else, you know, and I talked to him about it. Like, I was up front with him in the process, and he was like, he's like, I have no hesitation signing off on this. I'm like, great, let's go.
Yep. That's quite a bit of aviators that we talk to, is like my AME or the, you know, my CFI or whoever I'm flying with who sees me every day, they feel safe enough to fly with me, and they feel safe enough to write me off and say that I'm fit to fly. But some Yahoo at OKC is saying no.
Saying no. Yeah, exactly.
Little dusty farts.
Yeah.
Well, and the first like clarification letter that came from the FAA post my, like, I went to the ME, I had the exam, he signed off on it. He said, you're probably going to hear from them. They're going to have some questions. I was like, okay. So I was ready for that. And it came during my training. I got a certified letter from the FAA saying, here's the, you know, submit all your records. We're not, you know, we're unable to, we're unable to approve, you know, without more information, not denying it, but saying, hey, send us more stuff. And I took that to my flight instructor who I had already been flying with and was like, here's what I'm up against. And she was like, okay, well, let's, you know, let me talk to my chief pilot and see what they, you know, what they think. And they came back, all of them were like, well, you're doing great in training. We have no, you know, we don't not want to fly with you. But the overwhelming consensus there was keep going until they say no. It'll be way easier to fight this with a PPL than without, you know, to get certified and then try to go back after my third class versus if I halted training, you know, you can't even start training without a third class. Like,
they were
like, hammer down, let's go. And, you know, I was already in that mode anyway, but that motivated me even more to just get through it and make sure I get it done.
Which is so smart. And I'm really glad that they gave you that advice, because I feel like, you know, it's almost like having the FAA vouch for you in a sense, because you have to pass the same tests and it's all the same exam that everyone else has to do. So if you're proficient enough to pass, you know, like, how can they, you know, by their own standard, look at you and be like, oh, well, you know, but another thing that kind of boiled up in my mind as we were having that conversation is just the fact that the medical efficacy kind of seems to go out the window, because like you said, your doctor vouched for you. And I can imagine, you know, when you're vouching for someone like that and you're writing these letters, you're kind of putting yourself on the line a little bit there professionally and ethically. And for them to kind of throw that out the window completely, to me also is really nuts as well.
Is insulting. I feel bad for my psychiatrist, and the fact that she advocated so hard for me, you know, wrote an impassioned letter explaining, you know, my whole history. Here's what we've been up against, and here's why I think it's okay for them to go, well, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, we know better than you because we have this book from 1980.
Yeah. Dude, thump you over the head with it.
I haven't practiced real medicine in literally decades, but
exactly. Okay. Yep.
But so last question for you, and thank you again for like opening up and kind of having this thought process with us and having this conversation, because it is really important. But yeah, so I know you're positive so that you'll get your medical back, which is awesome to hear, because I feel like it's always real heartbreak when I hear somebody like give up. And I'm glad to hear that you're going to keep on fighting. So what is your overall goal with aviation?
I want an airplane real bad. The physicality of airplanes speaks to me, and it always has from when I was just a little kid. The smell, the way that just the
smell. I love that you said that. That's a big one for me.
The airplanes have, and they all have individual personality. And honestly, the reality of the state of general aviation today is that most airplanes that you encounter are older than you, right? The idea that you don't really own an airplane, that you kind of steward it for a while until it's time for somebody else, right?
Yeah.
That I love that idea so much. I want an airplane. I want an airplane. I want to be able to take it out. I want to be able to take care of it. I want to be able to upgrade it and not upgrade it and have it be a plane. Just, what I really want is to find that Taylor E2 that my grandfather bought in 1941, because it supposedly survived the war. My dad and I have been on a quest to try and find that particular airframe, and haven't come up with it yet. But I think that would be an absolute dream come true to find that thing.
That definitely speaks to me, because I'm also in the process of trying to get my dad's Cessna 172 back as well, because he owned it for a few years. He sold it before he married my mom, and I found it. It's still in Washington State, luckily. And I just wrote like an impassioned letter to the owner and was like, hey, we are linked, even though you don't know me, and please give me your airplane. But yes, it's such a fun goal to have. And, you know, airplanes are expensive. So, you know, like when you own one, it's definitely like this huge passion project. And I really hope that you guys find the plane. That would be amazing.
It would be.
Are we moving on to fun questions here, Emma?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay, so we always like to end the show with fun questions, get to know you on an even more intimate level. So what is an irrational fear that you have, Chris?
I'll tell you an irrational fear that I had for decades. I was absolutely convinced that if I drove over a paint test strip on a freeway, you know, like where they do the stripes to test the like resilience of freeway paint. I was convinced that if I drove over one of those, that I would spontaneously combust. And so I would, man, if I saw one coming, I'd swerve over to the other lane. And people would make fun of me for years. I just had that in my head. I don't know why. It was ridiculous. I've conquered that fear. I am able to now drive over paint tests without so much as a twitch.
I'm glad you overcame that fear.
Me too, because it was real dumb.
What, Emma, do you have an irrational fear?
I like was thinking about this, and I don't know. Submarines, like I hate submarines, and every single time I swim, it's all I think about. And I know that's really silly and that's very dumb, but ever since I was little, that's just been my irrational fear. And I love swimming. Like swimming is my favorite activity. But It lingers in the back of my mind. I don't like the idea of like inanimate objects in the ocean, like man-made objects in particular. When I was little, we used to, like, where I'm from, this big open water, we used to swim down to the bottom and like grab a handful of sand or like seashells or something. And my worst fear was I was either going to swim down and grab like a crab pot, or I was going to hit a submarine. Those were the two things that always.
That is a quality irrational fear.
Very that specific. Is. I was like, I never thought about that because I, you know, I'm a lake girl. I grew up on a lake too, and I never thought about submarines. It was always like the sturgeons, like the 6-foot sturgeons that I thought about. But my irrational fear, I would have to say, like birds flying in or around my head anywhere, I always feel like they're gonna bite me or do something crazy. Like I'm not a fan of birds. And there's a bunch of them here in Bellingham Bay. There's so many seagulls. So
you might have
they're either
OCD.
Gonna shit on me or they're going to come after my face. Like those are the two things I always think about.
They say that people, like, there's like a connection to people that have OCD and people not liking birds. I read that somewhere. I feel like it was like a Vice News article or something like funky like that. But immediately I was like, and you are very organized. So maybe there's
OCD,
a connection.
Though. I'm very organized. I have like 10 planners. That's true.
I would say I'm more OCD than you for sure.
Yeah. My husband though. Every time we leave the house, he's like, did you turn the stove off? Did you blow out the candles? I'm like, I didn't even light candles. He has to ask me that. And then he's like, I'll lock the door right in front of him. And he has to check the handle and make sure it's locked. So I know that I'm not OCD because of him.
That is funny. I will literally wake up in the dead of sleep to make sure that the front door is locked. Like, that's another irrational fear, I think. And that's not even an irrational fear. That's just like a fear that.
Yes.
Somebody's gonna be in my house.
Well, it could happen. But moving on, okay, so we got past our rational fears. Now we're going into a totally different question. I'll start with you, Chris. What's one of your most favorite books or genres that you like to read?
My all-time favorite book is The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
I haven't read it.
Oh, it's heartbreaking and haunting and beautiful and all of the things. I made the mistake of reading it on an airliner and I was just weeping. The person sitting next to me was looking at me like I was nuts, but it's fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I've read a lot of his books and they're all real good, but that one in particular is amazing.
I wrote it down so that I could read it because I love reading. So I'm definitely going to have to read that. My favorite book of all time is called Shantaram, and it's based in India. It's about this Australian guy. It's a true story. He was imprisoned in Australia and he escaped and he went to India and he took his life to Bombay. It was before Mumbai. Was called Mumbai. It was Bombay. And then he talks about all of the things he did there and really gets into the culture. And he actually joined like a militia. And it's just very interesting, very detailed. I love the way that he writes. And it really like was like, it made me think I need to go to India now. So that is by far my favorite book. What about you, Emma?
I haven't like done a lot of reading, but when I was in high school, I was homeschooled. So my mom like made me read. There was like a lot of books in my curriculum, but I realized that, like reading is kind of like watching television and I could basically read all day and pretend like I'm learning. So books were like the biggest getaway for me during high school. But I haven't really read much. My favorite book is The Once and Future King. I cannot remember who it's by, but it's a huge book. It's about King Arthur and Merlin, but it's kind of a twist on the story. It's a super old story, but it's about Merlin and Arthur growing up together.
That's T.H. White, isn't it?
Yes. Yep. I knew it ended in the name White, but I was like, gonna say, I think it's White, but that's super generic. But how do you know about that book? Because not a lot of people do.
I read a lot.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. And it's definitely one that like, I can always go back to and read. But I definitely have to say like a period piece for me. Like I like to be transported somewhere in time, but I don't like sci-fi or futuristic stuff at all.
I'm like, I like memoirs, like real life stories about people's lives. And I read a lot of different like influential people books because they're like, I don't know if they're like inspiring, but it's kind of crazy where they started their life and then where they ended up. So, and I love
if you want to, if you want a true story period piece that would fit right in with your podcast, try Wind, Sand, and Stars. It's a autobiography essentially by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. He was a pilot back when piloting was not a thing. Through the deserts of Africa and many, many crazy adventures.
Have you read Beryl Markham's book?
Who?
Beryl Markham?
No.
Oh, she's a female aviator and she also did like bush flying in Africa. And she's a great writer.
Right on.
Yeah. You just remind me of that when you said Africa.
That's, I was literally about to say, I was like, this is reminding me of a recommendation that someone made.
It was me.
But it was that book. Yep. Yeah.
Yes, that was an amazing book. But yeah, okay. Now that we talked about reading, it's like, I just actually got into reading like in the last few years. So I've been going to town. Last year was my New Year's goal was to read 34 books in a year and I did it. So I'm trying to maintain that goal each year. But anyways, last question for you, Chris, is if you're having a bad day, what is something that can instantly cheer you up?
Oh, that's easy. My kids.
Oh.
I have two teenage girls. They are an absolute riot to be around. If they're around me, then we just hang out and do stuff. And if they're not, then I'll send them a Marco Polo or a funny text or a joke. And yep, that's my kids for sure.
I love that.
Yeah, that's so cute. Emma, what about you? What will cheer you up?
Swimming. I love swimming. Like I said, I love swimming. And I would say my boyfriend, but let's just put boyfriend aside. I have to choose swimming. Like there's something really, I don't know, it just always makes me feel better. It always gives me a sense of like childlike happiness. So yeah, easy peasy, swimming.
Hell yeah.
What about you?
I would say there's so many. I'm simple. Like, it's kind of easy to cheer me up. But I think because me and my brother, I have a twin brother. So when we were little, like, it was like really simple things that we would do to kind of like get us into a better mood. So we'd take our change down to the gas station and like buy a Diet Pepsi. And we'd have like all pennies and the lady would have to count it out. So now it's like, that's what I equate to like happiness. Like if I'm in a bad mood, I'm like, I just need to go get a big gulp down at the 76 and I'll feel better. So that's what I do.
God, Coca-Cola is going to love that. That's a great little marketing. Like,
I know. Seriously. No, but like my dad used to do that too for us. So like whenever we got in like a, you know, a little tiff, because I love, Chris, that you said your teenage girls, you guys get along so well, because I was like a rotten child when I was a teenager. So, but my dad would do the same thing. He would go and get me a big, huge Diet Pepsi soda, like if he ever got mad at me, and then he'd give it to me and instantly I'd be like so happy. So I'm simple.
That reminds me of like when I was a kid, my dad used to take us places and if it was somewhere we didn't want to go, you know, we kind of would throw a fit, but he knew exactly how to settle us all down. He'd stop at this one gas station and they had bug juice and jungle juice. And the bug juice was fun because it had bugs on it and it had kind of like the cool bottle top, but the jungle juice was a better juice and it came in a carton. So either one, if we were going to get one or the other, instantly day made, so happy. And so that came across, like, I think my TikTok the other day, somebody was talking about bug juice and it literally made me smile so big. It brought me straight back.
Yes. It's like instant nostalgia. Yes. Love that.
That's probably why we associate so much happiness with it, is because it's like a total sugar rush.
Exactly.
Which isn't too bad, but all right, we are going to wrap up this week's episode. Chris, thank you so much again for joining us. I love this conversation and I'm wishing you all the best of luck.
Thank you so very much for letting me come on and tell my story. I think the more the people know about this issue and hear about these, hear stories about people that are going through this, the better.
Yeah. Definitely have to second that. Well, that is it, like I said, for this week. Thank you all so much for joining us. Always remember to hit the bell or whatever, hit like, subscribe, whatever your little heart is feeling. And remember to keep the blue side up and the brown side down. We'll see you all next week.